22nd of May 1982.
4 weeks out today, and we've done 10,200 miles. No external news updates for 24 hours now, though we're still surviving with all our communications problems. Lots of signal patching. On the home front, my diet seems to be working at best.
By the day of the sinking, Lieutenant Sefia's neat handwriting covers 18 pages of his diary. We've arrived at the entry that will be scrutinised intensely after the war. The entry that will cause the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, so much trouble. And Sefia too. It's written in two sittings. The first, after he comes off watch at 7:15 in the morning, 9 hours before the torpedoes.
Well, they're not stupid. They spent the night meticulously paralleling the exclusion zone about 18 miles to the south of it. Frustrating.
By the end of Sethia's first watch of the day, the Conqueror has been stalking the Belgrano for 40 hours, but it doesn't yet have permission to sink. Britain's own rules of engagement prohibit an attack unless the Belgrano intrudes into the exclusion zone. But when Sethia picks up his diary again that night, the Belgrano is at the bottom of the sea and 323 Argentinian men are dead.
We fired three Mark 8 torpedoes at the Belgrano. The captain on the attack periscope was screaming out orders. 10 down, starboard 30, half ahead, 150 revs. Everyone was hysterical, shouting and cheering, and it became quiet only after 2 or 3 minutes. The little things in life seem relatively unimportant as the prospect of death becomes so real. A signal was received. Brandy is for heroes.
Of the roughly 25,000 men Britain sent to the South Atlantic, 100 served with Lieutenant Sethia on HMS Conqueror.
So I was 17 and a half. Thought that was my first assignment, was HMS Conqueror. Excuse the phrase, but I was shit hot. I was good. I was good.
The crew all came from different backgrounds and had various levels of experience. New recruits and old hands.
You show me any World War I battleship and I can tell you exactly everything about it. It's funny, it's a piece of advice my father gave me. Become an expert in something. Which I thought, well, that's a bloody good idea.
There are 11 officers on board the submarine. The other men are known as ratings. During Operation Corporate, the crew spent 90 continuous days at sea together, all crammed into a 5,000-ton metal tube about the size of a large jumbo jet. Submariners call their boats iron coffins.
I remember lying in my bunk thinking, I hope I'll be all right. I hope I won't let myself down, my captain down, the crew down, the Navy down. But you don't know. You worry because it's all unknown. I've never been to war.
No one on the submarine had ever been to war. It's the one thing that all the men had in common. They'd all been on exercises before, but on the morning of May the 2nd, it was becoming clear that this was for real.
There was a fear of how you would deal with it. That fear, to me, became a concern about what was going to happen to my family and my children if I died, if I was killed.
More than four decades later, the crew all reflect differently on the events of that day.
Some of the gung-ho ones, quiet as a mouse, it affected different people in different ways. I'd rather have not been there, to be perfectly honest.
If you go to war, people die. Coping with it, we just got on.
A strange mathematical equation I've done in my head is that's three people each of us killed. That there were three times as many people killed as there were crew. War is brutal.
I can't say I've lost any sleep about it. It was a duty to be done, and it had to be done.
When I first went back to my church and I was asked by the minister, please stand up. You've come back in one piece. Thank the Lord. Thank God you're back in one piece with us. Can you give us an account of how you feel? I kind of felt, not lost, but I kind of felt, God, you know, what did we do?
I'm Andrew O'Hagan, and from the London Review of Books, this is the Belgrano Diary. Episode 2. Gotcha. We will get to the torpedoes, but to understand how the order to attack came to be made, we need to go back to May the 1st, the day HMS Conqueror first sighted the General Belgrano. It's taken 4 weeks to get there, but the British task force are now gathering in and around the 200-mile exclusion zone. The Argentinian Navy is in the same seas. Armed conflict is looking increasingly likely. But Britain has yet to declare war, and in fact, it never will. The entirety of Operation Corporate is conducted under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, the right to self-defence. On the diplomatic front, the American shuttle is officially dead in the water, but Britain's Foreign Secretary, Francis Pym, is back in Washington to explore any last possibilities for peace. Pym tells the world's press that, for now, Britain is planning no military action other than enforcing the exclusion zone.
What we've done so far is to secure the total exclusion zone, and there's no other military action envisaged at the moment other than making that secure.
Will Thatcher's war cabinet hold this line and wait for the Argentinian Navy to move into the zone, or will it loosen the rules of engagement? One man who is hoping for the latter is Rear Admiral Sandy Woodward, commander of the task force. Woodward wants to up the military ante, strike hard and fast, and knock the Argentinian Navy out of the war at the earliest opportunity. He's on board HMS Hermes, one of Britain's two aircraft carriers, just off the Falklands, and is talking up Britain's military capabilities.
I think they'd be very ill-advised to try and take us on, because they'll suffer some very severe losses. I would put our chances as being considerably better than the opposition.
On the journey south, Woodward has been petitioning the chiefs of staff to dump the exclusion zone. In one message, he writes that the zone is military nonsense and completely spitchers any prospect of further ops. Spitchers, by the way, is a good old posh word for fucks up. Woodward continues, if we wish to make a show of force, we should do it in style. It should be in full acceptance of the possible need to fight. If we have to fight, we should seek to engineer the best possible killing ground. Woodward devises a bold opening gambit to deceive the Argentinians into thinking a full-scale invasion is imminent. A series of bombing raids on the runway at Port Stanley, the capital of the Falklands. He explained his deception plan in an interview to ITN after the war.
The plan was to draw out their surface fleet and chop it up with our nuclear submarines while we ran away. We were the bait. The nuclear submarines. With the spears.
Woodward's concern was the task force were vulnerable to both the Argentine Navy and the Argentine Air Force. So he wanted to impose a maximum attrition on them before any landing took place.
The official historian of the Falklands War, Lawrence Friedman.
So his basic aim was to persuade the Argentine forces
that actually a landing is underway, that the main business has already started, to get out their navy, to get out their air force, and to take out what they can.
Argentina's only advantage in military terms is in the air, and so Woodward's primary target is their aircraft carrier, the 25 de Mayo. It's in a battle group to the north of the islands and is being tracked by another submarine, HMS Splendid. If the British can sink it, they will have neutralised the biggest threat to the task force. Thatcher signs off on Woodward's plan, authorising the bombing raids, and in a first significant change to the rules of engagement, she agrees that he can attack the aircraft carrier, even if it is found outside the exclusion zone.
Good afternoon. Two airstrips on the Falklands were bombed today by British planes. The attack was led by a Vulcan bomber, followed by a flight of Harriers. Admiral Sandy Woodward, the commander of the task force, who turned 50 today, said it was the best birthday present he could have wished for.
The key day was the first, and that was when hostilities opened. That was when that extraordinary Royal Air Force Vulcan raid took place on the airport at Port Stanley. That's when at least three or four destroyers or frigates started bombarding Argentine positions at Port Stanley.
David Ormand was private secretary to the Minister of Defence, John Nott.
That then led to GCHQ deciphering a series of increasingly aggressive messages. So Admiral Lombardo, their admiral in charge of South Atlantic operations, he sent a sort of message to the whole Argentine fleet saying, I expect you to conduct a massive attack on the British fleet.
Just to be clear, you'd intercepted these messages and they were known to you at the time?
Yes. There were three messages. The timing of the battle plan was at sunrise on the 2nd of May, was when they had decided they would launch their attack.
The Argentinian admirals have taken Woodward's bait. They think the British forces are about to land on the islands. Argentinian signals intercepted by Britain's intelligence gathering agency, GCHQ, reveal an attack order for the next day, a pincer movement on the British task force to take place at first light.
May 2nd, 1982. Trailing them discreetly from about 10,000 yards, hoping that our intelligence reports are accurate and that they're going to turn north into the zone.
On the morning of the 2nd of May, in anticipation of the Argentinian offensive, the captain of the submarine, Chris Rayford Brown, calls his officers together in the wardroom. They expect the Belgrano to move north at any moment and need to decide which torpedo to use. They have a choice of two weapons: the modern Tigerfish Mark 24s.
It was wire-guided, so you were in control of the torpedo all the time, except the wire kept breaking. It was not a very reliable weapon.
That's the navigation officer, John T. Powis. The other option is the Second World War vintage Mark 8s.
Which had first gone to sea in the Royal Navy in about 1932, and we still had it. Why? Well, because it was a reliable, straightforward weapon.
After a short discussion, the captain makes a call. Tim McClement, the second in command of the submarine.
The captain said, if we are required to attack, we're going to use the Mark 8 because we'll use a Second World War design torpedo to sink a Second World War built ship.
HMS Conqueror is ready to strike as soon as the Belgrano joins the expected Argentinian pincer movement and intrudes into the exclusion zone. At 8 o'clock in the morning, the Belgrano makes its move, but it's not the one that anybody is expecting.
And that's when it started heading back towards the west. We wondered why they'd done that. Are they retreating? Are they doing something else?
West is away from the British task force and towards the Argentinian mainland. British High Command doesn't know it yet, but the intelligence suggesting an Argentinian offensive is out of date. The attack's been called off, and the Belgrano and the rest of the fleet have been ordered to fall back.
What are we going to do? What are we going to be asked to do?
Just as the Belgrano starts to reverse course, Woodward makes a move of his own. His original plan is now redundant. The Argentinian ships aren't going to be drawn into the exclusion zone. There is no pincer movement. What's more, the task force has lost track of its primary target, the Argentinian aircraft carrier. But Woodward still has one ship in his sights. Here he is after the war, describing how he pushed the War Cabinet to change the rules of engagement again.
I need Belgrano taken out. The normal process of asking for a major change in rules of engagement meant my writing about a page and a half of reasons. That being considered by the military staff at home, taken to the politicians and debated, no doubt, for rather too long. So I put the signal on the submarine satellite. Within minutes, it was wrenched off it by flag officer submarines back home, who realised I had no such authority and wasn't going to allow it, quite correctly. But it enlivened them to take it very quickly to London and say, Woodward really wants this permission.
Woodward's first order doesn't reach the Conqueror, but that doesn't matter. His intervention is a bluff meant to concentrate minds back home, and it works. The Chief of the Defence Staff, Admiral Lewin, realises what Woodward is up to. He summons his driver and heads straight to Chequers, the Prime Minister's country retreat. Lewin is seeking a second change to the rules of engagement in 3 days. Permission to sink any Argentinian ship outside the exclusion zone, not just the aircraft carrier. Permission for all-out naval war.
We were all at Chequers. Admiral Lewin briefed the Prime Minister and the other ministers from the War Cabinet before lunch, before the formal meeting of the War Cabinet.
David Ormond again.
He explained that at that precise moment, a very anxious Admiral Woodward was expecting attacks by the carrier-borne aircraft, the Skyhawks. And that was the case that Lewin put forward. We've got to extend the rules of engagement to all the Argentine warships there might be. And it took 15, 20 minutes.
Was there any resistance in that 20 minutes?
None. None whatever.
20 minutes. Like one side of your average long play record. One member of the War Cabinet said it was the easiest decision they ever had to make. No written record exists, and we will never know exactly what was discussed. What we do know is what's decided. Thatcher agrees to change the rules of engagement and also, crucially, not to warn the Argentinians of this change. Lawrence Friedman again.
Basically, the key relationship was Lewin and Thatcher, and Thatcher trusted him. He was charming. She was susceptible to his charm. Lewin understood how to talk to Thatcher. She was very unwilling to deny the military anything.
Lewin and Woodward have what they want, permission to sink any Argentinian vessel they can find. As Mrs. Thatcher and the War Cabinet sit down to lunch, the attack order is written, encrypted, and then relayed to the Conqueror. All systems go. Change to the rules authorised. Sink the Belgrano.
They're doing about 13 knots and appear to be ambling on quite unconcernedly. No zigs, no sonar transmissions, and only the occasional radar sweep.
We're very aware of the fact they were outside the exclusion zone, and it seemed very apparent that they had no idea that anybody else was there, because we'd had no sonar contact from their sonar. They had not operated their equipment actively and gone ping, ping. I personally would not describe the Belgrano and her escorts ever as being as a threat. Had there been more signs of aggression, I think that the exclusion zone would have been penetrated, which it was not. The Argentines were particularly careful not to do that, not to cross a particular boundary, not to step too far. What was the point of having an exclusion zone if vessels were to be attacked outside it?
For the last 6 hours, Sethia and the crew on the Conqueror have been tracking the Belgrano as it heads west, away from the task force. As Thatcher and the War Cabinet eat their pudding, the Conqueror goes to periscope depth to relay this information to naval headquarters at Northwood and receive their latest orders. But in the same moment as they inform the chiefs of staff of the Belgrano's reversal of course, they get the order to go in and sink it. At a very precise 14:41 Zulu time, Northwood downloads the signal informing them that the Belgrano is heading away from the exclusion zone. They now know that the Argentinians appear to be pulling back. But this information is not passed on. As far as the admirals are concerned, the Belgrano's reversal of course is immaterial to their strategy. Lawrence Friedman.
It was too late to have any effect on these decisions. Woodward could see that the attack that he was anticipating hadn't happened, but it was irrelevant as far as they were concerned. It was irrelevant because part of their objective was to attrit the Argentine Navy. It wasn't simply because of the threat to the task force immediately imposed by the pincer movement. It was because they were thinking about a campaign of which this was one moment and more campaign was to come. So with Belgrano in Conqueror's sights, Woodward certainly would have been appalled if it had been let go simply because it was sort of tracking the exclusion zone rather than in the middle of it.
Woodward waits for news of a successful hit, but on the Conqueror, downloading and decrypting their orders is proving difficult.
We were beleaguered by serious communication defects. That really, really, really was bad. Well, you're getting lots of corruptions and things like that.
John Bysouth, the petty officer in charge of the radio shack and responsible for all signal traffic.
So we had to basically download the signal, run it, and then we'd interrogate the satellite again. Sometimes it might mean 5-6 signals before we actually got enough to piece each bit together. Just streams of paper tape.
Naval headquarters keeps broadcasting the signal. After 2 hours and numerous download attempts, the Conqueror's captain, Chris Rayford Brown, still doesn't know his orders.
It came to a stage where Tim McClement acted as a go-between between me and Rayford Brown because he was under pressure for the information and we was under pressure from him. And we couldn't do it any faster than what we were doing it. And things got very fraught at some stage, you know.
Tim McClement.
And I'd have 3/4 of one sentence, and then the next one I'd have 3/4 of the same sentence, but in a different place. So I patched it all together, all on one piece of paper to prove I hadn't cut anything. I took it up to the captain. The captain quite rightly said, "Thank you, XO, navigator, go and do the same thing." Because the captain had to make sure. So Jonty went down, did the whole thing again, came back with, "I agree with the XO."
Once we had that in our hand, we had permission to sink the Belgrano.
So the captain then said to me, "Inform the ship's company, we'll go to action stations at 1400. Got on the main broadcast, said, "Do you hear the XO speaking? Someone will go to action stations to conduct an arcade attack against the Belgrano. Hands to dinner." And it was roast pork and all the trimmings and apple crumble and custard. It was very tasty. Ate it all. No lumps in the custard.
Second of May, 1982. This afternoon, I knew what fear was. We received a signal authorizing us to sink the cruiser Belgrano, even though it was outside our exclusion zone.
The human mind, you know, thinks about all sorts of things, and sometimes it's the opposites happening at the same time. Yes, I'm in the Navy. I love the Navy. Gosh, what an incredibly exciting and inverted commas thing I'm going to be involved in. Equally, I would be very surprised if there was a single person on board who did not admit that at some stage he was scared shitless.
Trembling, terrified, at that point.
17-year-old Stephen McIntosh is one of the youngest on board.
And I remember sitting there and going to myself, bloody hell, this is actually happening. So I run down to the restroom where we were all watching a movie and saying, guys, it's happening. We've been given permission to engage. And they'd be like, we're freaking having, we have.
Lieutenant Commander Chris McDonald is the submarine's doctor.
I think it was a gulp and a breath, deep breath of this is for real. There was fear in as much as an anxiety about what might happen. So, the adrenaline was most definitely working well.
We went deep and opened from the cruiser's port side to about 4,000 yards. She was flanked by two destroyers. The tension in the control room was mounting steadily.
And the first thing that I was asked to do by the captain was to slow the submarine down and to do what's called catch a trim, which is achieving the best neutral buoyancy of a submarine. So to keep a 4,500-ton nuclear submarine exactly on depth to the nearest inch if you could.
The captain, he put the periscope up, quick all-round look, make sure everything's safe. He would then use the split image rangefinder by measuring the height of a known object on the target ship. And of course, every time he took one of those datum points, I would plot it on my local operations plot, and you could literally join the dots that you were getting a sensible track.
I wander around all the different plots, making sure that we've got the best possible solution. Time meant nothing. We were just so focused on doing what we were trained to do.
The Belgrano is a moving target, so they will fire three torpedoes in a slight arc to maximise the chance of a hit.
So the captain goes up and starts the drill for, you know, the firing setup, where he will press the bearing. But First Lieutenant calls out,
Do not fire!
And there's silence in the control room.
But he was the only person that had realised that the captain was going early, i.e. we're not there yet.
My job is to give the captain the best possible firing solution. That's my job. So that's why I said do not fire. But when we both turned around, there were about 16 other people in the control room, completely shocked, because the second in command's just stopped the captain firing the first torpedo since the Second World War. And they're actually looking between the two of us, going, what's going on?
Tim, the First Lieutenant, watched the dials move. So we then said, now, sir. And the captain then does the perfect drill. Yeah, on, bearing, that, cut, on, fire. Handles go up, periscope goes down. What you hear in the control room is click, whoosh, thump, bam, bam, as the engine starts. And it leaves the torpedo tube at a speed of about 23 knots and then very quickly accelerates to 45 knots. The next torpedo then does exactly the same thing 3 seconds later. And then the next torpedo 3 seconds after that.
You can feel it. You know, it's a ba-dum-ba-dum as it makes its way. And the next thing was, you know, history.
Up goes the periscope, and there's a huge fireball. And the next thing we hear, of course, is 3 seconds later, is of the next torpedo striking the bow. There was then another thump.
And I suppose there were 20 or 30 people in the control room at the time, shouting and cheering, the weapons have hit. And that lasted for about 15 seconds. And for a couple of reasons. I think that after the 15 seconds of cheering and shouting, perhaps sunk into people's minds, what have we just done?
We all had our own thoughts. I can remember mine were, there are over 1,000 sailors on board the Belgrano. They're a long way from home. The seawater temperature is cold and there's a storm coming, which is why there was silence.
One could have cut the atmosphere with a knife. The extraordinary thing was how it had changed within seconds, almost become a different world, mentally for all of us. And it was interesting to watch some people talk more quickly and authoritatively and determinedly, but others to look quiet, not tearful, but perhaps mentally tearful. I do remember actually listening to the Belgrano breaking up. If you can imagine a huge ballroom with a very, very high roof and an enormous 18th century glass chandelier, it sounded like the chandelier suddenly snapping its wire and falling to the ground. And it was tinkling, 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 tinkling. That sound, it sounds odd perhaps, but that was what it sounded like.
Is that upsetting to think about?
Yeah.
Even after all this time?
It's a funny thing, the human mind, yeah. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, there are some things that sort of... Do you understand that?
I do. Very much.
But I put on a very good mask most of the time, but it's this one area that I find a bit hard sometimes.
In the immediate aftermath, Conqueror flees the scene. After a couple of hours spent speeding away at depth, they come up to send the news of the attack back to Northwood.
May 1982.
I went to bed at 21:30, my heart pounding against my chest. Every little noise made me start. My ears had become sensitive to the slightest sound, and we're all finding that we jump whenever there's a bang. The lads have all taken it very well. A couple were very frightened outwardly, and the rest of us made do with being frightened inwardly. I don't think that most of them realise it yet. They're still, as I am, a bit high. However, everyone is smiling nervously, expounding on the rights and wrongs, recalling the tensions and feelings. I wonder how many died. As I write, I'm still a bit overwhelmed by it all. I can hardly believe the enormity of what we've done.
More than 1,000 sailors are on board the Belgrano when it's hit. The first torpedo strikes near the bow, but it's the second that causes the real damage, hitting the side of the ship.
At least 200 men die in the initial explosion. The ship quickly fills with smoke. Freezing cold water rushes in. There is confusion as sailors try to work out what is happening. One of those on board was Santiago Beloto, a gunner and a 19-year-old conscript.
When
the torpedoes hit, I was in the dormitory. The cruiser shook, the bunks collapsed, and the light went out immediately. As the water pipes burst, steam came rushing out, and there was a second explosion. We knew there had been some kind of enemy attack, but not what sort. Our first thoughts were for our crewmates, and we attempted to join them, although it was pitch black. There was a sepulchral silence and a strange acrid smell.
I'm interested in this question of how you handled the wounded. There must have been many wounded servicemen there. How did you deal with that?
The first things the medics did when the wounded started to come out was to administer morphine to the worst burned. Some people were unrecognizable. The medics drew an M on their foreheads in their own blood and also the time the morphine had been given. In the bow, where I was, the way the boat was listing meant that we had to make a human chain so the injured could pass behind us without toppling into the water, which was coming onto the deck, mixed with oil, which made everything very slippery.
When the torpedoes hit, all communication systems on board the ship are destroyed. The Belgrano cannot send a distress signal, delaying the rescue effort.
When was the decision made to abandon ship?
At a certain point, it was clear to us that the ship was going down. Some boarded the rafts so as to be able to help down the injured. There were many bodies on the top deck, where many of the worst injured died. The evacuation went smoothly. There was no panic or hysteria. Everyone abandoned ship. The last on deck were the captain and the petty officer Barrio Nuevo.
As the ship goes down, 800 men are evacuated in just 30 minutes.
Storm was coming and the sea was very choppy. Our life raft launched okay, but the water was very rough and the waves drove us toward the ship's hull and our raft tore when we hit it. In an instant, we were thrown into the water. It felt like millions and millions of pinpricks all over your body. First, we swam to one raft, but its lieutenant wouldn't let us on board. Then to another, where a guy we called Sarucho grabbed us and pulled us into the boat, with the two of us in the fetal position, covered in engine oil. At 1700, we saw the ship sink.
How does it feel to watch a vessel that you've served on for some time, which contains the bodies, perhaps, of colleagues, comrades of yours, go under the waves for the last time?
That ship was our home. We'd been living on it. And we were asking ourselves who the dead were. What had become of the crewmates we hadn't seen abandon ship? There was a sad moment where one of the rafts, with many of my crewmates, around 20 of them perhaps, ended up beneath the anchor winch. The winch came loose and fell on them.
It must be hard to get those things out of your line, even after decades.
These are things that stay with you for a long time. We ended up in a group of three rafts. Ours held 32, and it only had capacity of 20. We spent the night bailing water because the raft's side doors had been breached and the waves breaking over the roof were sinking it. We had to hold it up with our bodies so that it couldn't flip over. A storm had picked up, and it was really something. 100 kilometers per hour winds, 10 meters waves breaking over us.
And did you think, while you were in this overcrowded lifeboat in the roughest sea imaginable, that you would survive? Did you expect to survive?
There were certainly moments when I didn't think I was going to make it. I had one crewmate held between my legs, hugging him with them. Another guy placed his back against the man's chest. We urinated on one another for the heat.
The storm scatters the rafts in every direction. It takes 5 hours for Argentinian command to send out a reconnaissance plane and realize that the Belgrano has sunk. Rescue ships are dispatched to look for survivors, and it's a full 24 hours after the attack that the first life raft is found. It takes a further 24 hours to find them all.
At dawn, we were able to regain contact with the other rafts. Rescue vessels began to appear. A diver came alongside the raft and lashed it to the hull of the cruiser while we rocked up and down on the waves. A pilot ladder was let down for us to clamber up. Those of us who were able to do so unassisted climbed up. The others were hoisted up in a harness. The moment we hit the deck, all of us collapsed, cold and numb. Porque estábamos entumecidos.
Back in the UK, Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper announces the news of the sinking with the headline, "Gotcha." Our lad's whole cruiser, wallop. The Navy had the Argies on their knees last night. They torpedoed the 14,000-ton General Belgrano and left it a useless wreck. According to sources, Murdoch said that "Gotcha" was a bloody good headline.
3rd of May, 1982. The shit has hit the fan. I slept very badly, dreaming of bombs and explosions. If we are hit, at least the end would be quick. I hope it was with the poor bastards on the Belgrano. We shall all be old men when, if, we get back home.
If there was any doubt before, this is now most definitely a shooting war. The sinking of the Belgrano knocks the Argentinian Navy out of the conflict, but their Air Force are looking for revenge.
4th of May 1982. The first news of the day is not good. Sheffield had three air-launched Exocets fired at her. She's reported to be a floating hulk about 70 miles south of the Falklands.
43 hours after the attack on the Belgrano, an Argentinian fighter plane sinks the British destroyer HMS Sheffield, killing 20 crew. These are the first British casualties of the war.
All the time, I'm waiting for the sound room to scream, torpedo, torpedo, torpedo.
Over the next 6 weeks, the fighting over land, sea and air will be bloody and brutal.
Bad news for the skimmers again. Antelope has sunk.
Britain loses six more ships.
Coventry is still floating, but upside down.
More than 100 Argentinian aircraft are destroyed.
30 A4s and 20 Mirages. Argentina has now lost one-third of her air force.
On May the 21st, 3 weeks after the attack on the Belgrano, the task force begins to unload troops. The site of the landings, San Carlos Bay, is nicknamed Bomb Alley.
Christ, I hope the politicians see sense and call it a day. There are probably more dead and injured men than there are inhabitants of the Falklands.
By June, the task force has landed enough troops to launch the next phase. British battalions march towards Port Stanley, taking control of the surrounding hills.
I hope that this is justified and that this bloody stupid business can be finished soon. Life is precious, and killing is horrific and pointless. We've all learned this.
On June the 14th, completely surrounded, the Argentinian garrison surrenders. A commanding officer breaks the news to reporters embedded with the task force.
There is a white flag flying over Stanley. Very marvellous.
By the end of the war, 255 British servicemen are dead, three islanders and 649 Argentinians. Half of those were on the Belgrano.
June 15th, 1982. We've emerged as the only submarine to carry out an attack, though the press didn't seem to know our name, but doubtless will when we go sailing up the Clyde, flying the Jolly Roger. A great cheer went up all round when it was announced that we were finally going home.
At the Victory Parade in the City of London, thousands of tearful and cheering Britons salute the heroes of the task force. It isn't the Queen who takes the salute, it's Thatcher.
Children out with flags, office workers. Mrs. Thatcher gives a wave to the crowd. The Lord Mayor indicates...
Thatcher's gamble has paid off. Her triumphalism has awaited its true occasion, and the Falklands War provides it. She tours the country giving celebratory speeches. The Empire Strikes Back is the message. Imperial pride restored.
The spirit of the South Atlantic was the spirit of Britain at her best.
The British public is caught up in the moment and her poll ratings soar. The Thatcher of high inflation and high unemployment, of riots in Brixton and Toxteth, of the lowest approval rating since the Second World War, is gone. A new armour-plated Prime Minister has taken her place, and she's going to bring the vanquishing spirit of the war to bear on the situation at home.
What has indeed happened is that now, once again, Britain is not prepared to be pushed around. We have ceased to be a nation in retreat. And that is increasingly the mood of Britain. And that's why the rail strike won't do.
Before the task force set sail, the Ulster Unionist MP Enoch Powell questioned the Prime Minister's mettle. "The nation will learn in the next few weeks," he said, "of what stuff the Iron Lady is truly made." After victory, the results are in.
Is the Right Honourable Lady aware the report has now been received? It shows that the substance under test consisted of ferrous matter of the highest quality, that it is of exceptional tensile strength, is highly resistant to wear and tear and to stress, and may be used with advantage for all national purposes.
Like many ideologues, Thatcher isn't sentimental, except about herself. She hangs these words, signed by Powell, above her desk at number 10. Thatcher has finally lived up to her favourite sobriquet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you tonight in my Red Star chiffon evening gown. My face softly made up and my fair hair gently waved. The Iron Lady of the Western World.
The story shifts now from the war to its aftermath, and to the political controversy over the sinking, the Belgrano affair, as it came to be known. The events of May the 2nd are not controversial immediately. During the war itself, no one questioned the legitimacy of the attack. The circumstances seemed simple enough. The Belgrano was at sea and part of a battle group. The British had the chance to sink it. And they did. But after the fighting ends, amid all Thatcher's triumphalism and talk of iron leadership, questions do begin to be asked. The controversy to come will turn not so much on the act itself, but on the government's decision to give a false account of what happened.
Statement, Mr. Secretary Knott.
2 days after the sinking, Defence Minister John Knott makes an official statement to Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to make a statement about recent naval engagements in the South Atlantic.
The problem with this statement is that it's inaccurate in every crucial detail. All John Knott's claims are contradicted by the account in Sethia's diary.
The next day, on the 2nd of May, at 8 o'clock p.m. London time, one of our submarines detected the Argentine cruiser General Belgrano, escorted by two destroyers.
Wrong. John Knott is suggesting the Belgrano was spotted only minutes before it was attacked. Sethia's diary shows that it had been detected 48 hours earlier and was followed until the moment it was sunk.
This heavily armed surface attack group was close to the total exclusion zone and was closing on elements of our task force, which was only hours away. The threat to the task forces was such that the task force commander could ignore it only at his peril.
Wrong again. The Belgrano was not closing on the task force. It was heading in the opposite direction, towards the Argentinian coast, and had altered its course 11 hours before the attack.
The actual decision to launch a torpedo was clearly a decision taken by the submarine commander, but that decision...
No, it wasn't. The decision to sink the Belgrano wasn't made by the captain in the face of imminent danger. It was made many hours earlier when the War Cabinet changed the rules of engagement, authorising the Navy to sink any Argentinian vessel wherever it was found. These inaccuracies will be repeated again and again. On the same day as John Knott, Thatcher herself said...
Had we left it any later, it would have been too late. Then I might have had to have come to the House with the news that some of our ships had been sunk.
The government's version of events seems intended to exaggerate the threat level of the Belgrano, as if it was a case of sink or be sunk. During the war, the government had a near-total monopoly on information coming out of the South Atlantic. No one thought to query the official narrative. But as the task force returns to the UK, discrepancies start to emerge, and one man will make it his mission to unravel the government's lies.
¶¶
next time on the Belgrano Diary.
New and damning evidence is coming to the light of day. Members of the task force are beginning to talk.
I'm listening to our leaders basically just telling lies. So I did not want to become part of that lie.
Mrs. Thatcher would always have been rattled by someone who was quoting a great deal of detail.
It was a classic example of where a politician starts to pull on a thread.
Is it the submarine commander, or is it the Prime Minister who is lying?
I think that the Honourable Gentleman mustn't use that word. I'm sure he would rephrase that final comment.
Is it the submarine commander or the Prime Minister who's telling the truth?
The Belgrano Diary is a production from the documentary team at the London Review of Books. If you like this episode, please leave a rating and a review wherever you listened. This helps other listeners find the show. Episode 3, Small Lies, Big Lies, will be available next Thursday, April the 11th. You don't need to wait to listen to the rest of this series. If you click in the link in the show notes, you can access all the episodes right now, as well as hours of extended interviews. You can read a collection of the magazine's coverage of the Falklands War and the politics of the early 1980s on our website. There's a link to this in the show notes, where you will also find a list of the archival audio used in this episode. The series producer was Richard Curling. Ben Walker was the producer, and Zach Brophy, the story editor. Original music and sound design by Joel Cox. The words of Santiago Beloto were read by Julio Galan. I'm Andrew O'Hagan.